From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In the videotape first broadcast Sunday, Osama bin Laden said, "America will not live in peace before peace reigns in Palestine." Violence has been escalating in the Middle East over the past year. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with George Mitchell. He chaired an international commission on violence in the Middle East. Its mission was to fulfill the mandate agreed to at peace talks in 1999 and 2000. Mitchell also chaired the Northern Ireland peace talks in 1996 and is the former majority leader of the U.S. Senate. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Flights of Love, a collection of short stories by Bernhard Schlink. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stasio. Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda network said today the battle against the United States will not end until the U.S. withdraws from Muslim lands. NPR's Peter Kenyon is in Doha, Qatar. He says spokesman Suleiman Abdulgahith has called on Muslims everywhere to join the fight.
According to the videotape broadcast by Al Jazeera, the spokesman said that it is an obligation of every Muslim around the world to take up a holy war against America and its interests. And he made a point of saying that America has interests all over the world, the implication clearly being that they're not just looking for Muslims in the Middle East or perhaps in America to take up this cause, but all over the world, anywhere they can find anything connected to America to take the holy war there. It's a part of Osama bin Laden's theory of taking this holy war externally and trying to combat the enemy that he sees, which is America.
NPR's Peter Kenyon in Doha, Qatar. U.S. military officials say coalition forces now essentially have air supremacy over Afghanistan. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Richard Myers says some Afghan anti-aircraft and portable surface-to-air missiles remain intact, but he adds American and British forces will use tactics to keep out of range. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said that means bombing operations can be carried out more or less around the clock. United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan is expressing concern about the well-being of humanitarian workers in Afghanistan. The UN says four Afghan employees of a UN-funded mine clearance group were killed after Allied missiles hit their office building near Kabul. Linda Fasulo reports from the United Nations.
Secretary General Kofi Annan called the deaths of the four workers a hard blow for the UN and said the United Nations would do all it could to protect civilians. Annan also noted that the United States and Britain have assured the world body that their military efforts in Afghanistan would be targeted against the Taliban rulers and Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda organization. Meanwhile, the UN chief said the raids have complicated food and relief delivery, with few truck drivers wanting to travel in the country. Annan spoke to reporters after hearing an update about the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan, which has long suffered from civil war and several years of drought. For NPR News, I'm Linda Fasulo at the United Nations.
President Bush said today he'll limit congressional access to information on the current military operation. The president accused members of Congress of leaking secrets to the news media.
When the classified information first seeped into the public, I called him on the phone and said, "This can't stand. We can't have leaks of classified information. It's not in our nation's interests. We're now in extraordinary times."
On Wall Street, stock prices were lower. The Dow is off 15 points. You're listening to NPR News. In Gaza, Palestinian officials say they're investigating how three people were fatally shot yesterday when police broke up a demonstration praising Osama bin Laden. It is the worst internal clash in years. NPR's Jennifer Ludden is in Jerusalem.
Police say masked gunmen fired first, but the radical group Hamas, which called the student demonstrations in Gaza, denies the charge. A spokesman says he expects police to be arrested. Overnight, all political factions met and issued a statement expressing deep pain over the confrontation. Palestinian authorities then closed universities to encourage calm. They also banned foreign journalists from entering the Gaza Strip. The clash highlights a deep split between public sentiment and officials who've allied themselves with the U.S. and its anti-terror campaign. Yasser Arafat also appears to have stepped up efforts to enforce a truce with Israel. There are reports his forces arrested dozens of militants and warned of severe reprisals if there are attacks against Israelis. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Unrest continues in Pakistan following U.S.-led attacks inside neighboring Afghanistan. At least five people were shot to death by police outside the city of Quetta in the second day of violent protests. Elsewhere, hundreds of pro-Taliban demonstrators in the eastern city of Lahore stoned police, blocked roads, and chanted slogans against President Bush. An investigator says fragments resembling a missile payload have been found in the wreckage of a Russian jetliner that plunged into the Black Sea last week. The Russian investigator says the discovery supports the theory that an errant Ukrainian missile brought down the plane, something that is still being denied by the Ukraine. I'm Frank Stasio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM, the nature of what's to come, at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In a videotape that was first broadcast Sunday, Osama bin Laden said that America will not live in peace before peace reigns in Palestine. Yesterday, about 2,000 Palestinians participated in a pro-Bin Laden demonstration. Today, Palestinian authorities shut down universities and schools in Gaza to prevent further Bin Laden rallies. My guest George Mitchell was appointed by President Clinton to chair an international commission on violence in the Middle East. Its mission was to fulfill the mandate agreed to at the peace talks in 1999 and 2000. Mitchell also chaired the Northern Ireland peace talks in 1996. He served as a Democratic senator from Maine for 15 years. For the last six of those years, he was Senate Majority Leader. I spoke with George Mitchell this morning. I asked how important he thinks the Palestinian cause is to bin Laden.
It's clear that it was not the original motivation for him. His own statements and many publications about him over the years have indicated that it was the American military presence in Saudi Arabia at the time of the Gulf War that really turned him hostile to the United States. I have no doubt that, like many Muslims around the world, he's concerned about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and that has taken on in recent years an increasing prominence in his statements, I think at least in part to connect with the masses on the what's called the Arab street around the world. So I think it's a factor. I don't think it's the original motivating nor perhaps the dominant factor. It is, I think, significant and not commented sufficiently on in the American and Western press that a large part of his motivation is to overthrow the governments of Saudi Arabia and Egypt. Most of his fighters are Saudi or Egyptian, and they strongly favor the overthrow of the governments in those two countries. So it's a complicating mixture of motives that they have, but it's obvious that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is a factor, and particularly in the propaganda war for the hearts and minds of people throughout the region.
Yesterday, about 2,000 Palestinians demonstrated in support of bin Laden. What do you think that says?
Well, I think it says that the Palestinians are divided. They obviously recognize, as many of them said, and they're quoted in today's paper and on the news last night, they obviously recognize that bin Laden's concern for them is a relatively recent development. But they obviously like the idea that someone who has international attention is talking about their plight. At the same time, it seems rather clear that the leadership of the Palestinian Authority has made a choice, and they've decided that they don't want to ally themselves fully with bin Laden and his effort. They made a mistake 10 years ago when they aligned with Saddam Hussein in the Gulf conflict, and they don't want to repeat that mistake. And so they're trying now to make clear that they don't favor what he did and what he says, and they're trying to I guess you could call it tamped down the dissent, although it's obviously erupted in very violent and tragic ways yesterday. I don't know what's going to happen during the day today.
Ariel Sharon, Israel's prime minister, made a strong statement that he's since apologized for. He said to the United States, "Do not repeat the dreadful mistake of 1938 when enlightened European democracies decided to sacrifice Czechoslovakia for a convenient temporary solution. Do not try to appease the Arabs at our expense." Do you think he has a legitimate concern? Do you think it's likely that the U.S. will pressure Israel to make concessions in order to help keep the anti-terrorist alliance together, an alliance that includes many Arab countries?
No, I don't think it's likely that the United States will do anything that will jeopardize Israel's security or its right to exist as a free and sovereign state. I think the United States will do what it believes appropriate to try to encourage both the Israelis and the Palestinians to accept the recommendations of the commission, which I chaired, on violence in the Middle East, which the U.S. government has embraced, the first of which is an immediate and unconditional cessation of violence and a resumption of security cooperation. Now, I think what the president said was of concern to Prime Minister Sharon, not so much for the substance, but for the timing. After all, what the president said is that a Palestinian state has always been part of our vision. Well, it's certainly been American policy for many years. President Clinton stated it explicitly on many occasions, as have previous Israeli prime ministers, including Prime Minister Sharon himself just a few weeks ago. So I think it was really more the timing of it and the concern that you expressed in the question, that the United States would do something that would abandon Israel or sacrifice Israel's interests. I don't think that's likely to occur. I think what the United States is interested in is a peaceful resolution there, an end to the violence and conflict, and meaningful negotiation.
Do you think it would be possible to end the Islamic extremist terrorists directed at the United States before there is peace between the Palestinians and Israelis?
It will obviously be much more difficult. It clearly would be better for the broader war on terrorism if there is a cessation of violence among Palestinians and Israelis. But the fact is, of course, that the Al-Qaeda network and its affiliated organizations exist independent of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And therefore, it is appropriate for us to try to locate, disrupt, and destroy them, even if we're not successful in the effort to bring an end to hostilities in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Whether we can do it is impossible to say, and I think it's not realistic to think in absolutes in these areas. No society in all of human history has been able to attain the complete absence of violence. And there's been no period in world history for any sustained long time that there hasn't been violent action somewhere. I think more realistic is a significant reduction in such activities, the disruption and destruction of the existing and known organizations, which will make it difficult for others to follow.
The Israeli government is angry at the United States for not having put Hezbollah and Hamas on the list of terrorist groups that the United States is opposing in this war against terrorism. Hezbollah and Hamas are the two major anti-Israeli groups. Do you think that they should be on the list?
Well, that's really a matter for the administration. I'm not a part of the administration and have not been privy to their discussions with respect to how they decided who should go on lists. And so I don't have the information sufficient to comment on that. I will say that the president was quite careful in his speech to the Congress to identify our targets as those organizations with a global reach. And when he said those words, it immediately struck me, and I assume many other listeners, that he was in effect distinguishing Al-Qaeda from groups like Hamas and Hezbollah. Now, maybe that wasn't his intention. I don't know that. But I think the only persons who can answer that question are those within the administration who were directly involved in the debate and discussion leading up to the preparation of the list and what their motivation was.
My guest is former Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell. He chaired an international commission on violence in the Middle East. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is former Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell. He chaired an international commission on violence in the Middle East. The U.S. has named Iran and Syria as state sponsors of terrorism because of their support for Hezbollah and Hamas. Now Iran and Syria are kind of in the coalition against terrorism. They're partially in it. Is that fair to say? Are you concerned about how this war against terrorism is shifting international alliances and what that might mean for the future?
Well, it presents opportunities as well as challenges. For example, and I'll get to Iran and Syria in a moment, but to make the point, to illustrate the point I just made, we now have the opportunity to completely remake our relationship with Russia. Based upon this incident, this may be a pivot on which U.S.-Russian relations will turn sharply for the better. I don't think anyone, at least not many Americans, think that's a bad thing. So you have to look at it as, yes, a challenge with respect to some countries, but also a tremendous opportunity with respect to others. Now, let's take Iran specifically. Many Americans, unfortunately, and many Westerners regard Islam and the Muslim countries as monolithic, look at them as the same, treat them as the same. Well, of course, that's not the case. They're many. They're varied. They have different historic, cultural, linguistic societies. They themselves have fought wars. Traditionally, the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia and those close to it, with which we are allied, have viewed Iran and Iraq as counterweights. And Iran and Iraq fought a long war not too long ago. So we now regard Iraq as a huge enemy. That being the case, the most natural ally you'd want against Iraq is Iran. And there's been some indication that Iranians are tiring of the cultural revolution and the damage that's done to their economy and want a more moderate internal governance and a better relations with the United States. I think what the president has wisely done has suggested that we're not going to base our future policy exclusively on past deeds, basically saying those of you who sinned but are prepared to repent will be with you. Only if you're going to continue your sinful ways will you feel our wrath. I know that's not the words he used, but that's basically the message that he conveyed. So it's really a test for them as to what they're going to do now and in the future. It seems to me a rather skillful approach, considering the fact that we still regard Iraq under Saddam Hussein as a much more serious threat. In that case, we go back to Winston Churchill's maxim, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. It makes for uncomfortable temporary relationships. But if you want to pursue your primary objective, then this is a way to do it.
What's been going through your mind as you watch the violence escalate in the Middle East between Israel and the Palestinians?
And it's just been escalating increasingly, really hitting a height over the weekend since the beginning of the Second Intifada a year ago.
Well, it makes me very sad, deeply discouraged, and more resolved than ever that it has to be brought to an end. And I feel a sense of personal identification with it. It's very discouraging that there have been many ceasefires that haven't taken hold, that all of the parties, including the government of Israel and the Palestinian Authority, responded favorably to our commission's recommendations, and yet they don't seem to be able to take that first difficult step to get the process underway. In the meantime, more and more people are killed. It's very deeply saddening.
Well, the Israel and the Palestinians are in that spiral of tit-for-tat violence. Each blames the other for continuing the cycle of violence. What are some of your insights into how you can end a tit-for-tat cycle of violence like that?
We recommend it, and I think the only way you're going to do it is to just take a point in time and just say that's it. There's an immediate and unconditional cessation of violence and a resumption of security cooperation. If each side wants to get in the last lick, then it just isn't going to happen. The reality is, of course, that the what you call tit-for-tat and the retaliations, pretty soon you can't remember the first one. It's just back and forth, back and forth, and it's awful hard for political leaders to take that dramatic first step, primarily because there is a total lack of trust. Neither side believes anything the other side says. Each assumes the worst about the other, and each believes that it can't take a step because the other side can't be trusted to take a reciprocal step. And so what's needed is a painstaking effort to create what is effectively a chronology of confidence-building action that will enable one side to take the first step, secure in the knowledge that the other is going to take a second step, and then a third and a fourth. And back, if I could just take a moment to describe my experience in Northern Ireland. After we got an agreement in April of 1998, we all recognized that there would be great difficulty in implementing the agreement. I said so on the very day that I announced the agreement. Well, of course, that's what's happened even to this day. The result is not assured, and peace remains in doubt. About a year and a half later, in the fall of 1999, the process was on the verge of collapse, and the prime ministers of Britain and Ireland asked me to come back to try to help keep it going. I spent about 3.5 months over there. It only took me a couple of days to figure out what had to be done. The remainder of the 3.5 months was composing the kind of chronology that I've just described. And it was quite precise. At 9 o'clock on the morning of November 27th, the one political leader would make a statement, which was all agreed on in advance. The next day at 1 o'clock, an opposing political leader would make another statement. That was agreed on in advance. And then the next day, someone else would do something and so on, so that when the process began with the first statement, everybody knew each step that would occur over the ensuing month. Now, it took a long time to get them to agree on what those steps would be, the words and actions, and an even longer time to get them to trust that the other side would keep their part of the bargain. I think that's what's needed in the Middle East now. You've got to get them to the point where they believe enough that if they take a dramatic step, it'll be reciprocal. So far, nobody believes that, and so you can't get the first step taken.
Can you give an example of a confidence-building measure on each side that you think would help the other side?
Oh, yes. We were quite specific. We recommended more than a dozen of them. We said, for example, that the the Palestinian Authority had to make clear through concrete action their view that terrorism is reprehensible and unacceptable, and that they would do everything they could. They would make a 100% effort to prevent terrorist actions from taking place, including the arrest of people they knew who were involved in terrorism. That's a very difficult thing for the Palestinian Authority to do, as we've seen from the events that have occurred since then. We further specifically recommended that the Palestinian Authority had to make an aggressive effort to prevent Palestinian gunmen from using Palestinian-populated areas to fire on Israeli-populated areas. On the other side, we recommended that the government of Israel freeze all settlement construction activity throughout the region. It's been a source of, we felt, great concern and creating many flashpoints of the violence that's occurred. We also recommended that the government of Israel resume the transfer of tax payments that it collects and it previously transferred to the Palestinian Authority, that it lift the closures that now effectively prevent any economic activity from occurring within the within Gaza and the Palestinian territories, and a whole series of steps like that, both sides acting sometimes jointly, sometimes separately, in a way that will enable them to have at least enough confidence to begin the process of negotiation. That's the root cause now. There's zero confidence. There's total mistrust. And somehow the culture of peace, which was so carefully nourished over the past decade and which has now been completely shattered, has to be rebuilt to the point where they can resume negotiation.
George Mitchell chaired an International Commission on Violence in the Middle East. He's a former Democratic senator from Maine and former Senate Majority Leader. Our interview was recorded this morning. We'll hear more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From PBS, presenting Life 360, this week's episode looks at how random events and chance meetings can change lives. Friday at 9, local times may vary. And from Delacourt Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Chasing the Hawk, Looking for My Father, Finding Myself, a memoir by Andrew Sheehan. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, stopping the cycle of tit-for-tat violence. We continue our conversation with former Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell. He chaired an International Commission on Violence in the Middle East. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews Flights of Love, a new collection of short stories. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Osama bin Laden has tied his cause to the Palestinian cause. We're talking about violence and the peace process in the Middle East with George Mitchell. He chaired an international commission on violence in the Middle East. Mitchell also chaired the Northern Ireland peace talks in 1996. He served as a Democratic senator from Maine for 15 years. For the last six of those years, he was Senate Majority Leader. Let's continue the interview I recorded this morning with Mitchell. When we left off, he said that his commission's report recommended that the Palestinians make a 100% effort to stop terrorism. How much power do you think the Palestinian Authority has to prevent terrorist groups like Hamas and Hezbollah from attacking Israel?
Well, of course, that's a subject of great dispute, but I think it's rather evident, including as recently as yesterday, that they don't have 100% complete control. The language in our report calling upon them to make a 100% effort was originally suggested by the government of Israel. That language was proposed by them in recognition of the fact that the Palestinian Authority does not have 100% control but has not made a 100% effort. And no one can tell you for sure until it actually happens whether their control is 80% or 60% or maybe less. The problem is they haven't made the effort. And they have to make the maximum effort to prevent these terrorist actions from occurring so as to create some degree of confidence among the Israelis that they're serious and they're partners for peace. Terry, one of the real tragedies of this is that during what's come to be known as the Oslo process, primarily the decade of the 90s, the public on both sides came to believe slowly, grudgingly, and not fully, that they had a partner in peace on the other side. Israelis largely came to believe that most Palestinians had finally come around to accepting the existence of the State of Israel. Palestinians came to believe that most of the Israelis accepted the inevitability of a Palestinian state. Now, as a result of the violence of the past year, those beliefs no longer exist. The overwhelming majority of Israelis don't think they have a partner in peace. They think that the Palestinians remain committed to the total destruction of Israel. Conversely, the overwhelming majority of Palestinians now believe that the Israelis don't want a Palestinian state and that they'll never permit one to occur, and that's why they think all of these settlements are occurring, to make physically impossible a viable, contiguous Palestinian state.
But do you think that they're right in their points of view here?
No, I don't think so. I think on both sides there is still a willingness to proceed in a way that would permit an ultimate agreement. The fact of the matter is that those Palestinians who believe that Israel can be destroyed, that as their phrase used to be, we will drive the Jews into the sea, are living in a fantasy. It is not going to happen. Israel is there to stay. At the same time, those Israelis who believe, as some do and advocate, that Palestinians can simply be moved somewhere else and that there will not ever be a Palestinian state, I think they're wrong as well. I think that history and geography have destined these two peoples to live side by side. They're either going to live there in conflict, as they are now, or in peace. And I think the choice should be clear. Getting there is the difficult part.
Ariel Sharon was quite a hawk. Now he's the prime minister of the country. Do you consider him a good peace partner?
Well, I think that the leaders on both sides want to get out of the current situation. That's the first point. The second point is, it's really not up to me or President Bush or Secretary Powell or anybody outside of those countries to decide who their leaders should be. I mean, we Americans pride ourselves on many things, not least of which is the right of self-determination. The people of Israel have chosen Ariel Sharon as their prime minister, and therefore it is he with whom we must deal. The Palestinians have chosen Yasser Arafat as their leader, and therefore it is he with whom we must deal. No American would tolerate a situation where the Israelis said, well, we don't want to deal with President Bush because we don't like him, and besides, he didn't even get most votes in the last election. The fact is, he's our president. He's been chosen in a lawful process in this country. And so I think it is not relevant what an individual view may be of the willingness or desire of one of the leaders to act. The fact of the matter is they are the leaders. They've been chosen by their people, and they're the ones with whom we must deal. And what we've got to do is do the best we can to persuade them that their interests lie in trying to resolve this.
Israeli officials have basically said that they don't want to be perceived as rewarding violence. How do you get around that as somebody who's trying to negotiate peace?
Well, it's obviously a legitimate point of view, but it can also be used in a way that prevents anything from ever occurring. We encounter that still a problem in Northern Ireland, and of course it's repeatedly stated here. It's one of the problems, if I could go back to the settlements, which is such a contentious and difficult issue, very emotional, and we knew that it would be when we approached it. But the argument was made when we proposed a freeze on settlements that to do so would be to reward violence. The problem is that those who advanced that argument were opposed to freezing settlements when there was no violence. So it's obvious that the not rewarding violence argument was simply an additional argument to justify a position that was taken even when there was no violence. And that's the difficulty with it. Clearly, you don't want to reward violence. Equally clearly, you don't want that argument to paralyze you from ever doing anything that permits you to take a step toward a peaceful resolution. That's why I believe the only way that there's going to be any progress is to have a discussion among the parties in which they sit down and agree on a series of reciprocal steps that will be taken in a way that will give them at least the minimum confidence necessary to get into the process.
My guest is former Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell. He chaired an international commission on violence in the Middle East. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is former Senator and former Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell. He chaired a commission on violence in the Middle East. George Mitchell, you have been dealing with negotiating peace for several years now. The United States is now dealing with terrorists. I mean, they're not even taking credit for their actions, making it truly impossible to negotiate. Just talk a little bit about your thoughts now and having to deal with terrorists who won't take responsibility for their actions, who won't come out of hiding, who are totally unavailable for any kind of discussion. Then maybe you could share some of your thoughts about this, you know, what we're up against now and the difficulties of resolving it.
Oh, I am an advocate for peace, and I believe that one of the great opportunities for the United States is to use its tremendous power, military, economic, and its tremendous influence based upon our principles, not on our power, but on our principles, to encourage peace and justice and security wherever we can and wherever we deem our participation to be appropriate. And I know from my own experience in many of these areas that conflict creates a huge amount of death and destruction and is far less preferable as an alternative to peaceful dialogue and negotiation. At the same time, and having said that, I believe that there are circumstances in which the use of military force is justified. And I believe this to be one such time. It seems to me that it's a pretty basic and not too complicated analysis that one must make. If you look at the long list of terrorist attacks on the United States over the past 20 years, this latest incident is not isolated. It's part of a long chain of events. If you read the statement of the leaders of these organizations, made on television and other interviews and in writings, the only conclusion you can draw is that there are going to be more attacks no matter what we do. No matter what our response is, they're going to continue this assault for reasons that relate to their approach and their mentality and their objectives. In that case, it seems to me that our response should be determined by the answer to the following question. What action is best calculated from our standpoint to minimize the likelihood of attacks and to reduce their effectiveness when they occur? And it seems to me that it's plain common sense and self-defense to conclude that rather than not respond and simply await the next attack, we're better served if we actively and aggressively seek to locate, disrupt, and interdict the operations that these organizations are engaged in. Now, I respect the attitudes of those well-meaning people who argue against any military action, but it seems to me that their analysis is incomplete. The one member of Congress who voted against the use of force said, well, if we take military action, it doesn't guarantee that there won't be a response. Well, of course, that's correct. It can't guarantee that there won't be a response, but that's an incomplete analysis because it avoids the discussion which I've just had that says you're going to get a further action no matter what you do, and therefore the action we're now taking, I think, is calculated to that end. And I commend the president. It's limited. It's focused. We're trying to prevent loss of innocent civilian life. And we have a tightly targeted operation. I hope it will continue in that way to achieve the successful objective.
How concerned are you that in our attempt to stop terrorism, that through bombing parts of Afghanistan and perhaps in the future other countries, we're going to destabilize that whole area and further alienate many Muslims and turn some Muslims who aren't extremists into extremists, and that for every terrorist we kill, several others will be born?
That is, of course, an appropriate concern. It's one the administration plainly has in mind and which has served as a constraint on action so far, and it's something that you have to keep in mind. The reality is that you don't have available a perfect choice that is 100% all good with no downside. You've got a lot of 60-40s, 60% good and 40% downside, and you've got to choose between them. If the question is, do the negatives suggested in your question, are they sufficient to cause us not to take any military action? My answer is no. I think they cause us to consider the type of action we take, the length, the nature, the targets, and so forth. But I think on balance, were we to not respond on those grounds, the disadvantages would be greater.
Does it seem to you that the whole world, like most of the world, seems to be falling apart and caught up in some type of fighting of one sort or another, whether it's a local ethnic or religious fighting, or global disputes? That nearly wherever you look, there's some type of fighting going on.
No, I don't think it's an unusual time. If you look across the whole sweep of human history, what is unusual, of course, is the miracle of modern communications that brings into our living room each night dramatic events that previously people only read of or heard of in a way that didn't create the emotion that now exists. And secondly, you have the transforming nature of television. Very small demonstrations of a few hundred people with burning flags and burning tires can look like millions on television. So television is very powerful too, but there's no doubt that it transforms acts even as it reports and records them. And so we have to be cognizant of that as well. But I don't think that the world is falling apart. I think we can deal with the situation which now exists. It will take intelligent and visionary leadership. But I believe, to the contrary, that there are remarkable opportunities for the United States. If I could just say one thing, Terry, that is very much on my mind now, and you haven't asked about, and I do want to make a point. It's kind of tangential to this.
No,
but,
please go ahead.
But I think it fits. The United States is the dominant power, economic and military, in the world. Now, there have been dominant powers throughout all of human history. And there is a natural resentment, envy, and hostility toward the dominant power that is, in effect, it goes with the job or goes with the territory. We have to accept that. Now, for many young Americans who've never known anything else, what I fear is that they believe that American influence in the world is based exclusively on our power, and particularly right now as American bombs are dropping in Afghanistan. Well, while I believe power is essential and is an important component of our influence in the world, I believe it's secondary to our principles. I believe that the United States was a great nation long before it was the world's dominant economic and military power. Because what attracts people to the United States and what inspires people around the world are America's basic values: the primacy of individual liberty, the concept of equal justice under law, the concept of opportunity for every member of society. And so I think we have to be careful, as we use our power, to do so in a manner that is consistent with our basic ideals. I think that's the way we advance our cause, and that we promote the concept of freedom and democracy around the world. Where democracy does well, America does well. Where people are free, we benefit, not just them. And I think that's what we have to try to keep in mind as we try to navigate through these very difficult choices of the type you just described. How do you conduct this type of action when you run the risk of inflaming? How do you kill one terrorist without creating 10 more, and so forth and so on? I think if we do it in a manner consistent with our ideals, that will come through and in the end will serve our national interest best.
You're in the peace business at a time of a lot of wars. What keeps you optimistic enough to keep going with that as opposed to too cynical to go on?
Well, I have an absolute conviction that there's no such thing as a conflict that can't be ended. Conflicts are created and sustained by human beings. They can be ended by human beings. I believe that with all of my heart and soul. Now, as I said earlier, and I repeat, there are some times when the use of force is justified and a conflict is morally defensible. And I think this is one such time in the force that the United States is applying. I also believe that in the end, people have got to resolve their differences through dialogue, discussion, and hopefully, where they choose, democracy, rather than through the use of force. And that one of the things we we have to be careful in fact and in perception is not to permit our concentration on this military action to derail or cause us to abandon our efforts to achieve peace and security and justice in places around the world, like the Middle East. That's why I think it's important, as an independent action, for the United States to continue to aggressively pursue trying to bring that the immediate Israeli-Palestinian conflict to an end.
George Mitchell, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry, for having me.
George Mitchell chaired an international commission on violence in the Middle East. He's a former Democratic senator from Maine and former Senate Majority Leader. Our interview was recorded this morning. Coming up, Maureen Carrigan reviews a new collection of short stories by Bernhard Schlink called Flights of Love. This is Fresh Air. German writer Bernhard Schlink garnered international attention with his 1997 bestseller, The Reader. His latest book, a collection of short stories called Flights of Love, has been on the bestseller list in Germany for a year. Book critic Maureen Carrigan has a review of the collection, which was just translated into English.
Well, I kind of liked it. That's the tepid but genuine defense I've made of Bernhard Schlink's new short story collection, Flights of Love, to a couple of people I know who've been turned off to the book by early negative reviews in the New York Times and the New Republic. After talking to these doubters, I even went back and re-dipped into a few of the stories in the collection, and I still kind of liked it. Look, even at its best, Flights of Love, unlike its blockbuster predecessor, The Reader, is not the type of book that garners raves. For one thing, Schlink has a self-destructive tendency to conclude his short stories with endings that are either too cryptic or too implausible. So he undermines whatever literary magic he's managed to create in the preceding pages. Another potential strike against Schlink is that his characters are uniformly wan, not the kind of personalities likely to charm a reader. Drained by age or political struggles or the burdensome legacy of World War II, Schlink's protagonists regard their lives and love affairs with a fatalistic shrug, knowing full well they'll be alone in the end. They're the brooding German cousins to Anita Bruckner's doomed English recluses. And that's precisely what I liked about most of these stories, their dark melancholy, their Germanness. I know, it's dodgy to ascribe ethnic traits to literature. Schlink, in fact, devotes one of his stories, The Circumcision, to mulling over the complicated question of ethnic typecasting. But long ago, I had a literary love affair with the 19th century German romantics, Goethe, Herder, Novalis, and I like Schlink because he reminds me of his gloomy countrymen. Flights of Love is a veritable Oktoberfest of a collection. Almost every story here is stuffed like a schnitzel with self-consciously philosophizing characters, set in landscapes that are as flat and drab as potato pancakes, and drenched in lots of schmaltz about fate. It's a heavy menu, and I can understand why it would strike some readers as too glutinous, but I found most of these stories an agreeable change of palate. The seven stories in Flights of Love are loosely co-joined by the themes of failed romance, obsession, disillusionment, and desertion. As in so many collections, the first story is the strongest. Girl with Lizard recounts the fascination that an unnamed German boy has with a strange painting in his father's study. It depicts a young, dreamy-looking girl sitting on a rock next to a wet-eyed lizard. As the boy grows up and researches the painting's probable creator, a Dadaist who fled Europe with his Jewish wife during World War II, he has more and more reason to suspect that his lawyer father may have helped himself to the painting as war booty. The power of this story derives both from the mesmerizing descriptions of the painting itself, which seems to sap life from all those who become fixated on it, and from the formal and vastly empty relationship the boy, an only child, has with his elderly parents. Other stories here, whose narrative props aren't so distinctive, deserve a nod because of the language through which Schlink and his translator, John E. Woods, nail fleeting thoughts or emotions. The Other Man is a story in which a widower discovers that his now-dead wife long ago was unfaithful. When the story opens, the widower has just turned down offers from his adult children to come and pay them extended visits. Schlink captures the stubborn reclusiveness of grief when he says of the widower, he didn't want to live in any world of normality that wasn't his normality. And in The Woman at the Gas Station, an otherwise overly melodramatic story about the breakup of a decades-long marriage, Schlink describes the turning point when a husband's allure began to dim for his wife. She was on vacation with her husband in Rome, sitting with him in the Plaza Navona, and he patted a begging stray dog on the head with the same engagingly absent-minded gesture with which he sometimes patted her head. His charm was only a way of holding back and keeping his distance. It was a ritual by which her husband covered over the fact that he felt inconvenienced. Flights of Love, as its title suggests, is an entertaining short story collection whose effects are transitory. Another reason why I had to reread some of the stories is because they're easily forgotten. Schlink is adept at conjuring up a lot of Sturm und Drang, ultimately signifying not much.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Flights of Love by Bernhard Schlink. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Jeffrey Goldberg, who writes about the Middle East for The New Yorker, and Robert Kaplan, author of Soldiers of God with Islamic Warriors in Afghanistan and Pakistan. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.